Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. What's going on? Cleveland, boom, out of here. The Indians, after a 102-win regular season, just lost three straight to the Yankees, with the baby bombers moving on to the ALCS. Even Kyrie Irving came in from the top rope to clown Cleveland. Also, Parody Larry left one of the worst voicemails ever, and Rob, the grump, made his triumphant return to the jungle. Find out how both those calls went. And we had three excellent guests: Minnesota Vikings wide receiver Adam Thielen, Las Vegas Golden Knights head coach Gerard Gallant, and MLB and NHL reporter John Morosi. All of that in a bonus podcast Thursday. Alvy, let's get after it right now. I was the guy that told you yesterday before the game it was going to be just fine. You would be all right. You were going to win. I told you that. So this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you, and I know it hurts you a lot. Up 2-0 in that series, you find a way to come from ahead and lose to a team that wasn't just on the ropes. They were on the verge of firing their manager a day or two ago. And yet the team that won 22 straight could not win one of three. It is brutal. Just brutal. Even for you, Cleveland. You know I don't need to run down the stats. I know you have them memorized. You've lost six straight games when you've had a chance to clinch. The second time in less than a year that Cleveland has been eliminated at home. Instead of choking out the Yankees, they managed to choke themselves out again. This was not supposed to happen, because this team was supposed to be different, and because this was all setting up so well. Corey Kluber on the bump for Game 5. Edwin Encarnacion back in the lineup. You're at home. And then Didi Gregorius, who had done so little at the plate in the series, manages to do this in the first.
Didi swings and lines one to deep right. That ball is high. It is far. It is gone. Oh, my. Didi homers into the right field seats. Yes, indeedy. Didi Gregorius makes Yankee fans euphorious. He homers to right, and the Yankees draw first blood. They take a 1-0 lead.
Yes, indeedy. Look, that's not good. That's not good, but it's not terrible. It's only one run. You get it back in the bottom of the first. No, you won't, because you'll go 1-2-3 with two strikeouts. Then in the bottom of the second, you'll go 1-2-3 with two strikeouts. And then in the top of the third, yes, indeedy.
The 0-1 swung on and hit in the air to right field. That ball is high. It is far. It is gone. He's done it again. Yes, indeedy. How do you like that in the deciding Game 5? Didi's hit two home runs in a row. Didi Gregorius makes Yankee fans euphorious. He hits a two-run home run. And here in the third inning, the Yankees take a 3-0 lead.
And Yankee fans were euphorious. Hey, whatever the opposite of euphorious is, that's what the Indian fans were. 3-0. But again, not the end of the world. Surely Cleveland's bats will wake up now, right? Wrong. Bottom of the third, 1-2-3, two strikeouts. Bottom of the fourth, a single, and then three straight outs, including two more strikeouts. Cleveland finally chases CC Sabathia in the fifth when they score twice. They have two guys on and one out for Francisco Lindor, a chance to break this thing open. Except Joe Girardi, who may have saved his job, did the very obvious thing, the easiest thing. He hands the ball to an extremely filthy David Robertson.
And the 0-1 is grounded. Double play ball to short. Didi steps on second, fires to first. In time, double play. Great play, Didi. Don't forget, that's Lindor running, and he can really run. Didi had a touch second, twist his body, and that great arm, he fired a bullet to first for the 6-6-3 double play, and the Yankees retain the lead.
Yes, indeedy. A freaking stake, a dagger right through their heart. This guy comes in and makes two pitches and gets that double play ground ball. And then he just kept right on dealing. Dude was flat out nasty. 2 2/3 innings of no-hit ball. And then he turned that 3-2 lead over to Aroldis Chapman in the eighth. But Cleveland had another trick up their sleeve. Not to make the game close, mind you, but to make that pain even worse. Starlin Castro strikes out to lead off the ninth, but Aaron Hicks singles to left.
And the pitch is looped to left field. Racing in is Jackson. He can't get there. It's a base hit for Hicks, who makes a wide turn. Jackson fumbles the ball, and Hicks goes to second. Great break for the Yanks. Jackson probably looked up to see where Hicks was. So that's a single and an error.
That's a single and an error is right. Chase Headley pops out. Todd Frazier works a nine-pitch walk. And then one of the all-time postseason at-bats. Brett Gardner up there just grinding through everything.
Once again, it'll be a 3-2. The pitch swung on and lined as a base hit to right field. Hicks rounds third. He scores. Frazier goes to third. It is, here comes Frazier. Ball gets away in the infield. The throw home is not in time. Frazier scores on another Cleveland error. Gardner goes to second. A classic at-bat for Gardner.
One of the all-time at-bats. In fact, I'm not sure that at-bat's even over yet. I've never seen anything quite like that. This guy was grinding through everything. That was as insane an at-bat as you'll ever see. Fouling off everything. That was 12 pitches. It felt like 40. This guy fouls off five straight pitches and then laces one to right field, driving in two runs on the hit and the ensuing error. You can't say that Gardner did not earn every bit of those runs. But at the same time, what the hell, Cleveland? What the hell? When the wheels fall off that victory wagon, they didn't just fall off. They shattered into 1,000 pieces, and the wagon exploded. I mean, what the hell happened? One of the best fielding teams in the regular season commits 7 errors in the final 2 games, leading to 7 unearned runs. You think that might leave a mark? Any chance that that haunts these guys all winter? And if you don't call that a choke, what would you call it? And it wasn't just the fielders. Cleveland's batters, who were so patient during the regular season, were waving at everything, missing everything. A team that barely struck out during the regular season could not stop striking out in the postseason. And if their hitters weren't hitting, then their pitchers really weren't pitching. Corey Kluber wasn't the Klubot at all. He gave up 3 runs. He failed to get out of the 4th inning at home in a clinching game. I mean, terrible. Maybe this guy was more banged up than we thought, but he took the ball. So somehow a guy who went 11-1 with an ERA of 1.79 after the All-Star break had an ERA of 12.79 in this series, and he gave up 4 home runs in less than 7 innings. In other words, C-Town, when it mattered most, your team played its worst. It was hard to watch, even harder for me to say, but that was so very Cleveland. So very, very Cleveland. Believe me, I don't want to say it. I don't want to pile on, especially after I promised you yesterday right here that everything was going to be fine, that this team and this time, it would be really different. Except it wasn't. Same as it ever was, only worse. Much worse. I really didn't even think that that was possible. I'd love to have your back here, C-Town, but there is no defending what I just saw. I'll tip my hat to the Yankees, but only after calling out the Indians, because up 2-0, they did as much to lose it as the Yanks did to win it. And that was after being up 3-1 last year against the Cubs.
Yes, indeedy!
Why does this keep happening to this team, year after year, decade after decade? They just can't finish. Yes, indeedy!
Yes, indeedy!
Adam Thielen is my guest. So Monday night, kind of a tricky game, and that you're on the road against a division rival in prime time. Sam Bradford was struggling early on. Knowing all of that, how pleased were you then to have the team come out and pull out the win the way they did under those conditions?
Yeah, I mean, well, anytime you can get the win on the road in this division, you'll take it. And it doesn't really matter how you get it done as long as you do it. And, you know, we've had a tough time in the past, you know, there at Soldier Field, and it's a tough place to win. So we're happy with the win. Now we're excited to, you know, have another divisional game and be at home.
Adam, you were part of Kyle Rudolph's epic touchdown celebration Monday night. I've got to ask, where did the idea come from for that, and then how good did it feel to pull it off?
Yeah, I think Latavius was the one that came up with it, and then in the huddle before that play, Rudolph said, "We'll do it if we score," and whoever scores is the, you know, the person tagging people off. So it was kind of a fun little celebration, and I think we pulled it off pretty well.
It actually was an awesome celebration. But settle the big controversy, Adam. Was it duck, duck, goose, or a game of duck, duck, gray, duck?
Well, I think I'm the only one in the whole locker room that would say gray duck, but and I didn't even have a clue that anybody called it goose until I got to college. So it was always duck duck gray duck. But I think I'm outnumbered here as far as who would call it what.
That's funny. I'm kind of a duck duck goose guy myself, but I understand you being where you're from, it's got to be duck duck gray duck. Adam Thielen joining us now. Back in camp, you started to work more in the slot. What's that transition been like for you?
Yeah, you know, I think it's good because, you know, just to be more versatile. I mean, obviously, they can put me outside, they can put me in the slot, and, you know, it's fun for me. It's a different challenge. You're going against different coverages. You're going against different people in the slot. You know, sometimes it's a linebacker, safety, corner. So it's kind of fun. It makes you be on your toes a little more, and it gives you more versatility of whether you can run an inside route, outside, across the field, things like that. So, it's been fun, and I'm looking forward to just continuing to grow in that position.
Minnesota's at home against Green Bay. Adam Thielen is our guest. Now, Adam, for those who are not familiar with the details of your story, you were initially undrafted out of Minnesota State. What were your expectations like coming out of college?
You know, I don't know if I really had any expectations. I think for me it was just to come in and just prove that I belong. And I think early on, you know, going back to rookie mini camp and then going into training camp, I think every day I just gained a little more confidence and in myself, and then I knew I just had to go prove it on the field. And when those preseason games came along, or those opportunities I got in regular seasons further down the road, I just had to make sure I made good on those opportunities, because you never know when you're going to get them again.
All right, so you go from undrafted to 8 catches, to 12 catches, then to 69 receptions for nearly 1,000 yards last season. What was that breakout year like for you?
Well, it was awesome. It was awesome to get back into, you know, playing full-time offense. You know, obviously in college you're the man, and you're playing every snap, every down, and getting most of the majority of the targets. And then to come and sit on the bench and not get any targets, it's tough mentally. But last year was just an awesome opportunity to get those targets again, and just get out there and just play football. And that's really what it comes down to, is just feeling comfortable that you can just go out there and play like you did when you were 5 years old in the backyard.
Your offensive coordinator, Pat Shurmur, raves about your ability to judge the ball, then go up and get it. He compares it to a baseball outfielder. Is it something that comes naturally to you? And then what's your approach when the ball is coming to you and you've got to battle a DB to get it?
Yeah, I think it's something that has maybe came from the different sports I've played growing up. I think, obviously, I was a center fielder in baseball. I think that helped a ton. I think playing basketball, there's no way I'd be where I am today without playing basketball my whole life, just because of the body control that you learn, being able to move in space and handle contact when you're in the air. I think that's something that I take from basketball. So I think, you know, just it kind of does come natural from those things. And then on top of that, practicing how you play. You know, when you're at practice, you got to treat it like a game and go full speed, so you put yourself in those situations. And when you get to the game, it just comes more natural.
And golf. You played golf too. So basketball, baseball, golf, and football. Now you've got Green Bay coming up this weekend. Last time you faced the Packers, you had a huge game, 12 receptions, over 200 yards, 2 touchdowns. What do you remember most about that game? And then what's it like to put up huge numbers like that against a division rival?
Yeah, I mean, I just remember just going back and forth with them. You know, they would score, we'd score, they'd score, we'd score. And, you know, just being able to, again, going back to opportunity. You know, I had a lot of targets that game, a lot of opportunity, and that's when football is fun. When you're just out there playing football, you're not really thinking about much else than just getting open, beating the guy across from you, and everything else kind of just falls into place.
Now, before I let you go, the team had training camp in Mankato for the final time this year, which ends a run of 10 straight camps for you in Mankato going back to college. I mean, it's got to be a kick to have camp there. Jarius Wright said that he really likes going back there because he gets a chance to make fun of you because of all the pictures you're on or in on the wall. What do your teammates make of all that?
Yeah, I definitely get a lot of heat when we go back there, and people love that story of me going to college there and things like that. But yeah, you know, it was a blast for me to be there for, like you said, 10 years, 10 training camps, and I'm definitely going to miss it just because it was an opportunity for me to get back and get with some of my old coaches, old friends, and just people in the community that I got to know over the years. So it's definitely going to be different not getting back there, and I'll definitely have to make a special trip now just to get down there and see those people.
So, Adam, finally, a question you've been asked, but I've got to know. I mean, you grew up in a small town. You're a huge Vikings fan. You pattern yourself after all these guys, and now you're a Minnesota Viking, and you've got young kids patterning themselves after you. I mean, does the whole thing still feel a little bit surreal, and what's that like?
Yeah, you know, I get asked that a lot, and I think the best way I can explain it for me is I'm so busy and so in the moment and trying to do my job that I'm not really thinking about that. But I think when I'm done playing and able to look back at it and think about obviously playing on the same field or, you know, in the same team as Chris Carter and Randy Moss, guys I grew up watching, I think it'll be a little more special. But right now I'm just playing football, and right, honestly, it's no different than college or high school. It's still the same game, and for me, I'm just trying to win those individual matchups every week and have fun doing it.
If watching your baseball team blow a 2-0 series lead after blowing a 3-1 series lead last year was not bad enough, and getting bounced after losing three straight to the Yankees was not bad enough, after blowing a game 5 at home with your ace on the mound, if that were not bad enough, and all of that is, but there's more. Now, here comes a former Cleveland star to dump a truckload of salt right into your wounds. Actually, Kyrie Irving's comments had nothing to do with baseball, but everything to do with your city. You see, Kyrie is in Boston now, and he really wants you to know how much he's enjoying that city. Kyrie said yesterday, quote, "Boston, I'm driving in and thinking, I'm really playing in a real live sports city," end quote. C-Town, how's that taste? You're not, according to Kyrie, a real live sports city. I haven't heard anyone trash Cleveland like that since Jay Noah was torching the home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
You like it? You think Cleveland's cool? I mean, I never heard anybody say, "I'm going to Cleveland on vacation." What's so good about Cleveland?
Here's the difference. Kyrie's not just some guy from another team, or just some knucklehead Boston fan mocking you. He's the guy who lived in your city, worked in your city, help bring a title to your city, and now he's dumping on your city. Oh, and it's not just about sports. It's about everything in your town. The Boston Globe quotes Kyrie as saying, "It's exciting to be back on the East Coast. It's fast-paced. A lot of different cultures, food, and people. You get it all, especially in Boston. I was talking to my best friend the other day. It's a really major city. Coming from Cleveland, the Midwest, where the culture is different. And then you move to the East Coast, into Boston, and it's so real and alive. An ongoing, thriving city. Consistently, no matter what hour throughout the night." End quote. Well, how about that, C-Town? Why don't we take a moment to break down that series of jabs and insults, shall we? Boston is, quote, "exciting and fast-paced." Yeah, that insinuates that Cleveland is neither. Boston has a variety of cultures, food, and people, which would again indicate that C-Town comes up short in all those categories. Translation, Cleveland is boring and slow-paced with little diversity, nothing good to eat, and nowhere to go. Except Kyrie's not done. He wants you to know that he was talking to his best friend the other day and pointing out that Boston is, quote, "really a major city," which again would suggest that Cleveland is not. So how's that feel, Cleveland? Your baseball team gets knocked out, and now Kyrie is carving you by saying you're not a major city. This guy is this close to glossing you the mistake by the lake, reminding you that your river caught fire. And then he gets the real hammer out. Quote, "And then you move to the East Coast, into Boston. It's so real and alive, an ongoing, thriving city." I mean, freaking hell, C-Town. He just drilled you right between the eyes. How are you going to pick your teeth up off the canvas after that one? A non-thriving city blast. I mean, why not just say everybody who lives in Cleveland is ugly? I'm not sure what's worse. Kyrie wrecking that city like that, or that city just taking it? Cleveland, are you really going to let this happen? Pick your sports analogy. He's doing it to you, landing one haymaker after another, and you are not defending yourselves. Do I need to stop the fight because you're eating punches and not defending yourself? Or are you going to punch back? This guy is going behind the back, off the backboard, and throwing it down on your head. This guy is going all Didi Gregorius on your ass.
Yes, indeedy.
And yes, I know it's a little weird for Kyrie to be teeing off like this. We get it. We get it. You want it out of Cleveland. And now you are out of Cleveland. And you can't wait to tell you how great life is now that you're not living in Cleveland. Normally, in a situation like this, I'd say, hey, dial it back. Dial it back, and you should be better than this. Except I'm not doing it this time. First off, all this salt and pettiness is awesome. I mean, it's awesome because it's so salty and so petty. What do you care, dude? You're out of there. And he cannot wait to pile on and tell you how much better the city he's in right now than the one he used to live in. And secondly, the great thing about this, he's going to go back to that boring, slow-paced, non-major, non-thriving city of Cleveland on Tuesday for the season opener. And when I think about that, I think about two words from one Bartholomew Edward Scott. Can't wait.
Can't wait.
Can't wait.
Can't wait.
Can't wait. I'm glad this guy let it rip before that. I mean, there was going to be enough of an anticipation anyway before he got loose like that on that city. This guy is backing up truckloads of salt. Bench the salt, Kyrie. We are joined by Gerard Gallant. Can you take me back to Tuesday night? Before the home opener, there was a ceremony to honor and remember the victims of the October 1st shooting. Can you share the types of emotions that you were feeling during that particular ceremony?
You know what? It was real tough. The emotions are real tough. And, you know, we tried to plan that. I planned the emotions for this whole week. But once you've seen that, you know, the responders come out there and some of the victims' families come out there, it was real tough and emotional. But, you know, we got through that, and then it was a great ceremony. And I thought one of our captains, Derek Eklund, had a speech to the fans and to the first responders, and it was an unbelievable speech. So he did a great job with that. So it was a real good night.
You know, speaking of that speech, he's lived in Las Vegas for more than a decade, going back to his time with the Las Vegas Wranglers. He gave that speech to the crowd. Then he goes out and he scores a few minutes into the game. What did that mean to him, the fans, and the rest of the team?
Well, I just think it was meant to be, obviously. I mean, a guy like Derek, he doesn't score a whole lot of goals in his career, and especially, you know, in a big game like that. And he just went out there, and he played really well for us, and he was really proud. And obviously, it gave our team a great boost, and it gave our fans a great boost. So it's one of those things where it was meant to be, and our start was unbelievable in that game.
You know, as a head coach, you try to prepare your team for a hockey game, and it's always going to be bigger than a normal game because it was the inaugural home game. But what was it like to get you guys ready for Tuesday night?
No, that was a tough thing. And again, we talked about that for a couple of days before. We had some of our office staff come in and talk to the guys and tell them what was going to take place with the ceremonies and that. So the guys were prepared for that. And, you know, as a head coach, you just try and prepare your team for getting ready for the game and getting go out and play that game hard. But that game, it wasn't about winning the game. It was about remembering and honoring the victims and recognizing the police and the first responders. That was the biggest thing for us. And the game went perfect, but there was nothing about the game for us that night.
Gerard Gallant joining us on the program. A group of your players were eating dinner at the Cosmopolitan when the shooting happened at Mandalay Bay. You were at the airport picking up your daughter. So what was the whole process like for you to check in to make sure that everybody was okay?
Yeah, well, you know what? Their travel coordinator and our office staff people were texting all the players right away just to get in touch with everybody. And it didn't take until the next day before, you know, every player got back to them. So it was tough. It was a tough night for everybody. And, you know, the next day we found out about noon that there was nobody on our staff that was affected by it, you know, in the organization. So we were very fortunate. And like you said, everybody loves country music. So if we wouldn't have played that night, probably a lot of our guys and even myself probably would have been there. So it was tough, definitely.
You know, just one more thought about that. The cliche, of course, is that there's not a manual or a book that you can just take off the shelf for dealing with something like this and then coaching your team. So how have you gone about approaching it?
Well, you know what? It's just every day we try to heal a little bit, and we try to go out there and do our jobs and work hard. I mean, when we get to the rink, it was going on the ice and practicing, getting ready for the player season opening games. And the good thing about it was I think we went on the road for the first two games, and we sort of got away from the city a little bit because it was tough. I mean, guys were coming in every day, and it's not easy dealing with a situation like that. And we just try to, you know, stick to hockey. And I know our guys, the opportunity they had, they went out in the community the first few days, and they went to, you know, they went to see the first responders, they went to police station, they went to fire departments, and they're trying to support everybody and doing the best they could, and you know, they don't donate any blood and the whole thing. So our players are good people, and they did a real good job in the community for sure.
Gerard Gallant sharing stats with us. All right, so you've won every single game you've played. Marc-Andre Fleury is playing well. James Neal's got 5 goals in 3 games. What's the vibe like around the team, and did you ever imagine getting off to a start quite like this?
Well, not really. I mean, obviously the first game in Dallas, our goaltender stole that game. Of course, he made 45 saves, and he was outstanding, and that's what Fleury can do for you. But our team's really come together, and they're working hard, and you know, they're competing and playing for jobs every night. So we're happy with the start. I mean, I think we're a better team than what some people thought we were going to be. But again, there's going to be some ups and downs. But we just want to get better every day and hopefully keep working hard.
You know, before I let you go, if you go back to the spring, you had a number of other coaching opportunities available. So what was it about the Vegas Golden Knights that made you so interested?
Well, the first time I met with George and Kelly McCrimmon and the ownership, Mr. Foley, you know, I sat down and had a, it was probably 2 weeks after I got let go in Florida, and we had some good meetings. It was a good interview and good meetings, and you know what? I said to myself, this is a good opportunity, and hopefully, you know, they'll offer me a contract sometime here. And 3.5 months later, we kept talking, and we were discussing it, and, you know, the right opportunity came up, and I'm really intrigued by it. And like I said, Vegas is a great city. You know, I think we're going to build something real, real good here together as a group, and I like our group, so, you know, it definitely intrigued me for sure.
Okay, now you were an assistant with the Columbus Blue Jackets during their first season as an expansion team, and when you first arrived in Columbus, there wasn't even a travel hockey team for your son, Jason, to play on. So in a sense, you weren't just building an NHL team, you were building a fan base and a hockey culture. How do you go about doing that, and how do you plan on doing that in Vegas?
Well, you know what? Vegas is outstanding. I mean, like you said, there's not a... some of the minor hockey here, one of our assistant coaches, Ryan Craig's young fella, plays in the minor hockey system. And he said so far it's been really good. Like, the talent level is good, and they're going to build off that. But I think the biggest thing is the more rinks you build, and we have a brand new facility here with 2 sheets of ice, the more kids are going to play. And now that they get the exposure from an NHL team, the kids are just going to take off in this community, and it's going to build a program. The same thing that happened in Columbus. I mean, there's 3 or 4 kids that I know from Columbus, the days in Columbus, Gordon Murphy's son. There's a couple others that are playing in the NHL today. And back then, like I said, there was no travel hockey, so it doesn't take long to grow.
Now, I'm going to play this, but I'm going to stop it along the way so you can follow my exact train of thought as I heard it for the first time. Because I'll always remember where I was the first time I heard this call. Unlike the podcast, which is getting better and better every single week, this particular voice message gets worse and worse as we go.
Hey, Jim, how are you? It's Aaron Rodgers.
Hey, Jim, how are you? It's Aaron Rodgers. Is there anybody anywhere who doesn't already know who is behind this horrible impression? Can you run that back one more time, Alvin, in the event that maybe somewhere someone doesn't know, although you all do, but who is it, do you think, is behind this terrible impression?
Hey, Jim, how are you? It's Aaron Rodgers.
Is there anybody anywhere who has listened to this show for more than 1 week that doesn't know that not only is that not Aaron Rodgers, that is Parody Larry? I should have stopped and deleted it right then and there, but I guess I sort of want to know where Lawrence was going with it this time.
Hey, Jim, how are you? It's Aaron Rodgers. Hey, listen, I want to thank you once again for letting me on your podcast. That dose of jungle karma was just what I needed to finish off the Packers in that last-minute win.
Finish off the Packers. Aaron Rodgers is calling me to finish off the Packers. All right, how many of you just asked yourself, is he plastered? Most of you, right? Larry, what is that? I mean, that Aaron Rodgers is kind of like some sort of part New Jersey, part drunk, part Southern little twang you got going there. The guy's a California native, Larry. I don't know who you're pretending to be. It felt great, though, to finish off the Packers. I mean, you mean the Cowboys, right, Larry? Why the hell would Aaron Rodgers be finishing off the Packers in a last-minute win? How do you screw that up? You ever see that bright yellow helmet that Aaron Rodgers always wears? That G stands for Green Bay. He wears that helmet because he plays for the Packers. He didn't finish off the Packers. I'm going to call is already shaping up as one of the worst ever. Let's just go ahead and play it to see if it will go down as the worst ever.
Hey, Jim, how are you? It's Aaron Rodgers. Hey, listen, I want to thank you once again for letting me on your podcast. That dose of jungle karma was just what I needed to finish off the Packers in that last-minute win. So just for you, I got my friend Parody Larry here. Hey, what's up, Aaron? I'm good. Would you sing me my favorite song? No problem. Here you go.
Oh, this is great. So what Larry then does is insert him. He inserts himself into an already failed bit that already sounds like himself. So now this great method actor is passing the phone back and forth between two characters with the same exact wasted, allegedly, voice. One of which just finished beating his own team in a last-minute victory. And incredibly enough, he's got a parody teed up, which is perfect. And now I'm so glad that I didn't delete this earlier because I can't wait to hear what he has.
Just for you, I got my friend Parody Larry here. Hey, what's up, Aaron? I'm good. Would you sing me my favorite song? No problem. Here you go. Hit the road, Dak. Cowboys can't win no more, no more, no more, no more. Jerry Jones says, circumcise them like a mosquito. Circumcise them like a mosquito. That's all. I'm out.
Yeah, that's more than enough, Lawrence. Hit the road, Dak. Hit the road, Dak. Where have I heard that before? Huh. Oh, yeah, now I remember. I heard it right around this time last year when you called in with it. Hey, Larry, I'm glad that you thought that was fire enough to reset yourself on the voicemail. I mean, in a way, I guess you knew you'd get through. Unlike this show, where I can't block you from getting through. I can't keep you from getting through there. You knew you'd get through. Glad you went through that extremely well-written and well-acted two-man comedy routine to set up Hit the Road, Dak. That was totally worth it, Lawrence. Totally worth it. That's a 40-second phone call with about 40 different cringeworthy moments. Lawrence, are you proud of yourself? Because now you're the leader in the clubhouse for the worst voicemail ever. And I'm not sure anybody is going to catch you. You're looking back and you're waving at people. You've turned around and you're running backwards over the finish line. And I'll tell you something else, Larry. Do not bother to listen back when podcast episode 8 drops later today. It's not in it. You did not make it in. So for the dozen or so other messages that I did keep on tape, check out episode 8 of the Jim Rome podcast later on today. Kurt Warner is in. Ike Taylor is in. Lawrence is not in. And if you haven't figured out the podcast game yet, all you have to do, if you're an Apple user and you check out iTunes, get it there. If you're on Android and you want to see Google Play, you can do that. If you don't have a smartphone, just go to jimrome.com. Under the audio tab, you do not need to have a smartphone to check this out. Again, I'm not looking for anything from you other than that you subscribe and maybe leave a review if you're feeling it. It does not cost anything. It is free. Premium content, and it's free. Yeah, but Rome, how can you call that premium content when you have garbage like Parody Larry and his two-man crew?
Garbage.
Because he's not on it. I'm giving you an example of things that don't make it on. Because it's premium content. He's not on it. First email through after that. And it's not even an email. It's just a subject. And the subject reads, and Parody Larry is allowed to drive people around for a living? Stephen S.A. Stevie is. Larry, as we know, drives a cab. Can you imagine getting in that guy's cab one day? Hey, how you doing there, partner? I'm great, sir. How are you? I just need to go downtown. Yeah, we're going to go downtown. I'm going to sing you a little song. Hit the road, Dak. John Morosi is my guest. What was your reaction when you first heard that Steven Strasburg might not pitch in Game 4?
Well, Jim, it was a continuation of what's been a longstanding narrative for his career, which was, of course, to this point in time until yesterday, he had never won a playoff start. He did not pitch at all in 2012 when he was not injured, as we well know the story of him being shut down 5 years ago. And there had been this enough data points, let's say, of a belief that perhaps this is someone who was not answering the bell unless he was feeling 100% physically strong and all things working perfectly. And yesterday, Jim, was his great opportunity to prove otherwise, to really prove whether it was media critics or even those critics in his own clubhouse and the opposition and the sort of Major League Baseball writ large, people around the game, that he can be, to use the baseball colloquial term, a bulldog and an ace at this time of year. And he was that last night. That was a career-defining game, Jim, for Steven Strasburg. He changed the entire opinion of the industry about him with one game. And it's amazing. He's a quiet guy. He didn't have to say a single word. He just pitched. And his motivation for doing so was he bending and acknowledging, in a certain sense, the criticism that was out there? Perhaps. But I think the big thing was he felt good enough to pitch, and he took the initiative to tell Dusty Baker, to tell the Nationals he was ready to go, and good on him for doing it. And the Nationals have a chance now tonight to win a decisive fifth game at home, John, and advance to the NLCS for the first time since moving to Washington, D.C.
I was just going to get right there. Excuse me. John Morosi joining us. So maybe, John, he does change the way he's seen the narrative about him, and he manned up. I mean, he was absolutely tremendous last night. But to your point, there's a win like that and what it might do for his reputation, and then there's a win like that and what it might do for the series. How do you think Washington shows up in Game 5 after winning Game 4 the way they did?
Well, to borrow the Theo Epstein line from 2004 when they came back and beat the Yankees, maybe not quite as epic of an upset, but he said, now we have to go beat Finland, the echoes of the Miracle on Ice. Well, now they have to beat Finland. That was not the last game. They have to win one more game for it to really matter. And, of course, tonight, they've got the choice of Roark on regular rest, and now Gio Gonzalez is back in play for the Nationals. You've got to like their chances, Jim, just because they're back at home and their hitters have not clicked at all offensively in this series. Harper, Murphy, Rendon, Worth, Turner, the entire collection of guys, Zimmerman, they really have not collectively done much at all, and you have to think that getting a second look at Kyle Hendricks in this series will help them get on track and find their groove offensively. You just look at it and say a collection of hitters this good cannot possibly continue to struggle on this level. Even looking at yesterday, they scored the one unearned run on the miscue by Addison Russell in the Cubs infield, and then a grand slam by Michael A. Taylor, who had just two plate appearances in last year's playoffs and was 0-for-2 with two strikeouts last year. So all of a sudden he comes in and is a very integral person to their offense, at least in Game 4. So I have to think, Jim, they find a way to get it done at home. And let's not overlook the history here. The Washington Nationals are part of a continuation of postseason struggles in our nation's capital. Now, there was not baseball there for about 30 years, but still, Jim, the last Washington, D.C.-based baseball team to win a postseason series of any kind was the 1924 Washington Senators. That was back in the World Series. So it's looking at almost 100 years. We talked about the Cubs drought last year. The Nationals, at least for our nation's capital, the drought is nearly as long.
It's incredible. It's not just baseball. It's also basketball and it's hockey as well.
Right.
John Morosi joining us. All right, John. So shifting over to the American League, what kind of thoughts do you have when you think about what happened in Cleveland last night and the fact that Cleveland lost yet another clinching game, this time at home?
Stunning. Jim, it really is stunning. I was there. I covered the conclusion of their winning streak. I was there for, I think, wins number 20 and 21. And when I left the ballpark after that 21st straight win in September, I thought to myself, I'm coming back here for the World Series, no question about it. This is not my last trip to Cleveland for baseball this year, and yet it was. And that is really surprising when you think about the quality of their rotation, just the quality of their entire team. You win that many games in a row, 22 straight, you would have to think that you'd be able to close out a 2-0 series lead in the first round against a team that, in some level, was in disarray after Joe Girardi's decision to not challenge the replay in Game 2. but they've lost three straight. And now, as Matt Vasgersian said on the air last night on FS1, Terry Francona becomes the first manager ever to lose six straight potential clinching games over two consecutive playoffs. That's just remarkable when you think about that for someone who I believe, Jim, is a Hall of Fame manager. This was not Terry Francona's fault. I think you look back and say Corey Kluber might win the Cy Young. You'd like to get more out of him than they got in this series. That certainly was a big reason why the bullpen had to throw a lot of innings. And, of course, yesterday it was Kluber with one more abbreviated start. So that was one reason. And also offensively, I think that but for a couple big innings here and there, the Yankees were simply the better team. And now it almost transports us back, Jim, to the 1990s. You've got a young, charismatic Yankee team. And whether it's 95 when the Yankees didn't win the World Series or 96 when they did, you do get that sense that there's been a window for other teams to win, whether it was Kansas City or Cleveland last year, and perhaps now Houston for this year. You better win now because, Jim, the Yankees are young, they're well-run, and now they also have still the financial might behind them. This, I believe, is the beginning of a very special era of Yankees baseball.
That's so true, John, because they're ahead of schedule. They were not supposed to be this good this soon. We knew they'd be good. We knew they were working this great plan, but they're ahead of schedule. John, go back to your point about the Indians. I mean, it's not just that they lost three straight. It's a team that was so good defensively and so hard to strike out that suddenly became so sloppy in the field, and they're whiffing left and right. How much of that, in your opinion, was about the pressure of the moment, and then how much of that was about the Yankee pitching and their bullpen in particular?
That's a great point, Jim, about the moment. And I think last year, the Indians, they were historically at least the undercard to the Cubs. We were all focused so much on the Cubs, and the Indians very nearly, they were one swing away on numerous occasions from winning that series. And even though they have the weight of history since 1948 not winning the World Series, the Indians were, I think, a little more relaxed last year. This year, they had that phenomenal regular season. They add Edwin Encarnacion. They've got potentially the Cy Young winner in Kluber. They bring back Michael Brantley. They have their excuses to not win were basically zero. And so now you have to go out there and you're expected to win. And that changes things a bit, I think, for a ball club. So I think that's a great observation on your part, Jim. I think that really the tightness on defense, even saw Francisco Lindor make a key mistake yesterday. He almost never does that. It just was a strange look for that team. Once they got up 2-0, you thought after that big comeback in game two, well, it's a certainty they're going to win, and who knows what happens then to Joe Girardi with his future in New York. But everything changed there, game three, game four in the Bronx. And then, of course, a stunning game last night in Cleveland. So I think it's a great observation, Jim, that they maybe now for the first time started to feel that weight of history and just simply could not find a way to maybe internalize it and withstand it, because that looked like to me to be a tight team on the field last night for the Indians.
John Morosi, for a few more moments. You mentioned Girardi, John. It seemed like he was as good as gone. Maybe that's an overreaction. Maybe it's not. Where do you think that leaves him right now, seeing the way they came back and play the way they did?
You know, Jim, it's a great question, because I spoke to Joe Girardi late in the regular season. I asked him if he wants to continue managing, and he said, yes, I do. And he said he was going to put it to his family as a democratic vote, if you will, among those in his household to see if they all wanted to continue that lifestyle, because he talks about what a sacrifice it is for his family to do it. So I get the sense he still wants to. He's still a very young man in the whole course of managing. And, of course, next year, assuming he stays with the Yankees, he has a chance to be the youngest Yankee manager with 1,000 wins since Joe McCarthy. So he really has had a historic run with this franchise, the most wins in baseball since the day he took over in 2008, and yet a lot of questions about him. So at least there were after game two. I think he probably stays, in part because he found a way to get through the first round, and also because, Jim, if they let him go, I'm not sure who that Mike Babcock-type name, as I use the hockey example, where it's that home run of a hire that you have to go get him, the Jim Harbaugh, if you will. There's not that name right now in MLB that you could find to say, well, I know this person can withstand the crush of the media in New York. It's such a unique job, and Girardi, I think, does a very good job with it, much better than maybe he gets credit for. So I think Girardi stays, and I think that what happened last night really helped clinch that outcome for Joe Girardi and the Yankees.
It's a good point. And I know Harbaugh, for a fact, would not handle New York well. That would not go well at all. John, let me ask you.
He's barely handling Ann Arbor well right now.
There you go. And they love him there.
That result on Saturday.
So you can call him the Grump, or you can call him Rob G in the CLE. Whatever you want to call him, here he is. We go to C-Town right now.
Rome, what's up? It's good to be back. Haven't talked to you in a while.
Probably not since that rap.
Hey, thanks. I'm not going to try to be a champion. I'm a nervous wreck. I'm just going to try to survive and shrink Larry down to size. When I was in high school, I was in a rap group. So hopefully I still have some of the skills. All right, here I go. You guys probably don't miss me because the Grump doesn't have a good rep. But you didn't know how to dance, so me and Lance taught you the two-step. You scoffed and laughed, so I cut down all the trees in the jungle so you couldn't breathe. I cut down all the trees in the jungle. This is what I have to say about the rap of my past in Cleveland losing. The cure for pain is in the pain. You have to feel it. You don't run from it. You feel it, and then you let it go. See, I've been taking classes to deal with my stress. If you could see from that rap, you know, I have anxiety issues, very bad anxiety issues. You know, before, I couldn't even talk this long without getting run. So just remember what I said. The cure for pain is in the pain, and I'm moving to Boston. Have a good day, Rome. Love you.
Clones, thank you so much for listening and for checking out Episode 7 of the Jim Rome Podcast with TMZ founder Harvey Levin. Episode 8 drops a little bit later on today. Hall of Famer Kurt Warner and Jungle legend Ike Taylor will both be there. The grind includes Friday. Talk to you then. I'm out.